Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortez Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on The Scoop, the city of Burnaby is affirming the city's stance on 2SLGBTQIA+ advocacy by raising the pride flag. Danny Nesvrandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. And Tex the grizzly killed on Texada Island has residents devastated. More on that coming from Heather Watson at CHLY in Nanaimo. And the future of emergency response in Whitsett is in the hands of two men who are working tirelessly to come up with creative solutions to ensure the safety of the community. Pam Hassan at CACK News in Smithers dives in. I'm Dan Messick. You're listening to The Scoop.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On July 21st, local 2SLGBTQIA+ advocacy group Burnaby Pride, along with the City of Burnaby, held an event outside of Burnaby City Hall where the Intersex Progress Pride flag was raised next to the British Columbia and Canada flags. The flag raising marks a week of celebration taking place 1 week before Burnaby's annual Pride Festival on July 26th. First to speak at the event was Burnaby City Councilor Daniel Tatro, who emphasized the city's support of Burnaby's queer community, as well as its stance against anti-2SLGBTQIA+ discrimination.
And also, just by being here today, you're showing your support. You're doing your part. And also, we here to remember that Pride is also joyous and a vibrant celebration. And a reminder that we must continue to push back against bigotry, hatred, and discrimination. And again, not just today, but every day. In our community, our differences don't divide us. They are what make us special. And I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to show my support. And I'm thrilled to see you here as well.
This sentiment was echoed by other speakers at the event, including Azwa Rojbi, a coordinator for Burnaby Pride.
One of the important things we have to continue talking about is Pride started as a protest, and it is continues to be a protest. We don't have to look very far to see our rights being challenged and taken away from us, whether that is in provinces nearby here in Canada or across the border in the United States or around the world. So we have to continue, as the speaker before me, the councillor said, fighting against bigotry, challenging bigotry. And it's important for people that live in Burnaby to see that reflected in their elected officials and here at City Hall.
Lastly, Vishad Deeplaw, the senior manager for equity, diversity, and inclusion for the City of Burnaby, spoke on his personal experiences and how that led him to the City of Burnaby.
I've always looked to try and find that sense of belonging and where I felt I genuinely should be. Through my teens, growing up in South Africa, I was the obese kid, I was the kid of color, I was also the gay kid. And for the time that I grew up, it was not the best place to be. It has its challenges. Then when I wanted to marry my husband 22 years ago, we were told we could not get married because it was not legal. We then struggled to have a son, which we had to wait as well for laws to change for us to actually become parents. When we became parents, we had to fight with the idea of, firstly, not getting parental leave because there's no maternal figure. At the same time, we had to fight for the fact that some schools didn't want our son in their schooling system. Later on, we immigrated for a better life for my son, which is 8 years ago. And if anybody else here are immigrants, you know, you're then also trying to fit in once again. You're trying to find your footing, you're trying to see where you belong. But I want to share that in 2022, I joined the City of Burnaby. Today I can share that I have found my sense of belonging. From our mayor, council, our city leadership, colleagues, from across all departments who I can also call friends, I feel seen.
At the end of the event, the Intersex Progress Pride flag was raised. Beginning this year's celebration of Pride in the city of Burnaby. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is a CHLY and CVOX news update.
This is a community that hasn't had any predators for many, many, many years. And it's a community completely unprepared for a predator as such as a grizzly bear, with all the attractants everywhere.
On July 15th at 11:42 a.m., the Conservation Officer Service, or COS, posted to social media that the grizzly bear who had taken up residence on Texada Island was found shot dead. The results of the necropsy have yet to be shared, and the identity of the shooter has not been made public. The bear, nicknamed Tex by local resident and advocate Katrin Glenn Bittner, had been on the island since late May.
On May 25th, Tex has swum over from Powell River to Texada Island, and I knew instantly. At first, I was excited, and then I was like, in the same second, I knew this was not going to be good due to the community.
Glenn Bittner says that the lack of awareness on the island meant many attractants, things that would draw the bear, were left out. Anything from bird feeders to unsecured garbage to unlocked vehicles. She says that even livestock on the island is not protected the way it is in areas that regularly cohabitate with predators like grizzly bears.
I basically started being a voice for Tex when, as soon as I heard there is a kill order on him, I've become his voice. On June 1st, I have opened up a Facebook page called Safe Tex, the Texada Island Grizzly Bears. And I spoke about myself. I spoke about the community. I have tried to educate the people about bears. I have tried to educate people about around their property. There was just zero awareness on Texada Island of coexistence with a grizzly bear.
Glenn Bittner says that bears hold a special place in her family. Her brother, Dr. David Bittner, is a biologist, bear researcher, photographer, and speaker. Glenn Bittner spent several weeks with her brother in Alaska observing a dense population of brown bears. She says she also learned to coexist with bears while working with livestock on farms and ranches in BC.
I really got to see bears, their behavior, everything, the way they're misunderstood, the way everything gets misinterpreted. And they are so forgiven. They're most amazing teachers, and we can learn so much from them if we just want to.
Glenn Bittner shares what the reaction was when the community learned of the death.
When we found out of the death of Tex, the community is absolutely devastated. It broke many, many people's hearts. And this was inevitable, 100%. This should have never come to this. And the ministry has failed us and have failed Tex the most.
Glenn Bittner details how she learned of what happened to Tex earlier this week. First, with a tip from a friend that the bear had been injured on Monday.
On Monday, I received a phone call from a friend of mine that was out in the area on Texada Island, and she has been stopped by the RCMP to make her aware that there is a wounded grizzly bear, and the wound was caused by a gunshot, and they didn't know where he was. And to make her aware, she phoned me. I phoned the RCMP right away, and they have made a statement with me, and they confirmed with me that the bear has been shot at. He is been wounded. They couldn't confirm the seriousness of the wound, and we made it public on social media. And several hours, or maybe 4 or 5 hours after that, a confession has been made by the shooter that has destroyed Tex on Sunday evening with the 6 gunshots that tried to hide the body for 24 hours, and that it got confessed, and he needs to be held accountable now. This was totally legal. Tex has always been a respectful bear, very respectful bear. For the people that were afraid of Tex, just his presence feared them. So most people that have seen Tex on Texada Island misinterpreted the encounters with him and did not get to see the true, beautiful, gentle bear he was.
Glenn Bittner explains that she is confident in calling Tex a gentle bear, as she feels none of the encounters could be described as aggressive, or they would have ended completely differently. There was only one report of a livestock encounter, which the Conservation Officer Service investigated and released the following statement. Quote, on June 10 and 11, 2025, on Taxada Island, conservation officers responded to a complaint of a grizzly bear chasing livestock. The COS investigation determined no livestock were attacked and conflict prevention advice was provided to residents. End quote. Glenn Bittner says that the government is in part responsible for the death of the bear due to a failure to act.
The fear-based narrative spread from people here, including the government through COS, was intense. It was pure hatred against these animals, and it was truly split. 30% of Taxada residents wanted this bear destroyed, and lots of people wanted to see him translocated. We had, since the 9th of June, we had everything organized for Texas. It's over a month as of right now, that we had a home that has been greatly offered from Chief John Powell from the Mamalilikulu territory, that he would like to give Tex a home, and the fundings were there. Everything was organized, and there has been silence. The government, the ministries would not approve this plan for a translocation that was basically set up from bear biologists, leader bear biologists, and Chief John Powell with the First Nation.
The 30% statistic mentioned comes from an informal survey held on an online messaging board popular among Taxada residents. Communication from the COS prior to the death of the grizzly detailed two previous relocation attempts of this same bear twice in September of 2024, first from Gibson's, then from Seashelt. The statement declared in no uncertain terms, quote, in this case, it would not be in the interest of public safety to relocate the bear a third time, end quote. Despite this public statement, it seems plans were taking shape behind the scenes to move the bear after all. On Tuesday, following the COS post confirming the death of the bear, a statement was released by Randine Neal, Minister of Water, Land and Resource Stewardship, and MLA for Powell River Sunshine Coast. The statement included the following, quote, the timing is especially unfortunate as we were actively working with First Nations on a new plan to attempt to capture and translocate the grizzly bear from Taxada Island to a remote area up the coast, far away from communities. This was done in partnership with First Nations who had come forward and requested this approach, end quote. A statement from the Tla'amin Nation on Wednesday supports the claim that plans were in place to relocate the bear. Quote, a coordinated relocation effort between the Seashelt, Tla'amin, and Homolko First Nations was already underway when Tex was illegally shot, maimed, and killed. The plan, which had been approved by conservation officials, involved setting traps to safely move Tex to a remote area at the head of Butte Inlet. We are deeply saddened by this outcome. Tex's life mattered, and our nations had come together in a good way to find a peaceful solution. End quote. The statement also shared that the Tla'amin Nation took custody of the remains and held a ceremony on Tuesday to honor the spirit of the grizzly bear. Whether knowledge of the secret relocation plan would have stopped the shooter from taking Tex's life is unknown. Glenn Bittner says this was not the first attempt on the bear's life.
There was, like I said, the 30% people that wanted him dead, but there was also the people that just wanted to be heroes. He has been shot at last Monday, a week ago, missed. He has been chased with two ATVs, where we've seen the videos afterwards with him panting, obviously in distress. And with the shooting that destroyed him was knowing his behavior and no interest in livestock. This was just pure, this was not out of self-defense, 100%. And it was not, he was known to be wanting to shoot the bear.
Glenn Bittner says that the community needs to learn to adapt so that the same scenario is not repeated again.
We need to be proactive on Taxada now, more so than ever. Even with Tex being gone now, we cannot stop to be proactive to make this island that we can welcome a bear and be ready for him, and that it will not repeat itself again, because it was unacceptable what happened with Tex.
Glenn Bittner says that she and her brother, Dr. David Bittner, as well as wildlife advocate Ellie Lam, will be working further to educate the community and alleviate the fear of bears.
Especially our youth, that we teach them just like we taught them how to cross a road safely, how to be with wildlife. It's respectful living in nature, respectful with yourself, being respectful to your surroundings.
Glenn Bittner says it is time for everyone to pause and open their eyes, to observe a different perspective on wildlife and learn from animals without fear.
Everybody seems to want to live in nature here, but nobody seems to want to live with nature. I will not stop being a voice for bears. We will come again to Taxada Island, and we will be prepared, and we're not going to make the same mistake, and I will be their voice.
Anyone with information regarding the bear's death can call the Report All Poachers and Polluters hotline at 1-877-952-7277. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This is CICK News. A high school in Whitsett is now offering a life-saving opportunity for students. A local teacher, who's also a licensed paramedic, is running a 5-month emergency medical responder course, essentially advanced first aid, that qualifies graduates to work on ambulances. The course was condensed from an intensive 1-month program to make it more accessible at the high school level. It's part of a province-wide push to train more paramedics, and the instructor says demand is strong with the new classes already planned for Smithers and Whitsett this fall. Let's hear from that instructor now.
I'm Matt Anderson. I'm a teacher and paramedic. So I teach an EMR course. It's an emergency medical responder course. I'm a teacher by trade, but I normally teach kindergarten grade 1. That's my thing. And then I got this paramedic license, and I still taught grade 1, like up till 2 years ago.
And so it's July 10th that we're speaking, and you said that you have students that just wrote a very difficult exam. Can you tell me a little bit about the exam, and then also what the success rate was of your students? Yeah.
So my students just finished up in June, and what they have to do in the course, they have to complete a midterm and a final exam and a practical exam with me, which isn't too bad. It's challenging. It's a lot. But after they're done the course, they have to get licensed. I certify them, and then they get licensed so they're able to work within their scope of practice. And licensing is through the EMALB board of BC, and they're usually out in Victoria. So they actually fly down here, and they watch the students do a practical exam, which are 2 40-minute exams. They can't make a mistake really in these. One's trauma, one's medical, a random call in each category, and they have to complete those both in a certain amount of time and very high pressure. But the kids did really good. 6 out of 7 passed that wanted to license. And the course itself is worth 4 high school credits as well. So I get lots of students that just jump in, just want the credits. They don't license, which is fine. They just pass a course through me. Yeah, and of the ones that licensed, we have one now working for BC Ambulance, and almost all the rest that are wanting to work for BC Ambulance, they just have to wait till they're 19.
Students are preparing for the kinds of calls that ambulance crews see daily. Medical emergencies like overdoses, diabetic crises, and heart attacks requiring CPR, as well as trauma calls like car crashes, serious falls, and workplace accidents. You were also telling me before that typically these exams have like 90% failure.
Oh, last year, June of last year, the education coordinator, I was talking with her, said that the fail rate was 90% in licensing across the board, EMRs, PCPs, ACPs, all those license levels. So at a very high fail rate in the standard way it's presented, which is 1 month, very intense course. But with this 5-month course, with high school students, it's more in depth and they can wrap their head around it more. It's not such a crash course. And yeah, so I had a really good success rate.
So after these students receive their license, and that's an EMR license.
EMR license.
What then would be the next natural step? Will some of them stop there? And then what can
right.
they do as EMRs?
So they can work on ambulance. They can work for BC Ambulance, or they can get a job in industry as medics.
Okay.
And we'll have priority over OFA3s. It's higher.
What's an OFA3?
Occupational first aid level 3. But you got your first aid level 1, 2, 3. Then you have something called FR, first responder. Then you have EMR.
This course gives students an expanded scope of practice, allowing them to perform more advanced life-saving interventions. Emergency medical responders can now administer critical medications like epinephrine and asthma inhalers, once only available from higher-level paramedics or in the hospital. This recent update means that they can draw up and deliver these drugs on the spot, which is especially vital in remote communities where every minute counts. Okay, so a pulse check on what need a community like Whitsett has for more trained individuals and people, like you said, above that OFSR.
OFA.
So what is that? Yeah, what are you seeing that this is a gap that you're trying to actually fill?
Yeah, I've been doing this since about 2012. I've been assigned as the medical officer, and I had like my level 1 back then, way over my head. And I went to calls that were way over my head. So I ended up getting more training, got my EMR, got my PCP, worked for BC Ambulance. And now I do the same thing here. But there's a huge need for it. I'm on the fire department here. We have a significant structural fire, maybe once a year, once every 2 years. But medical calls, we have, you worked it out, it's about one a day. It's about one medical call a day, and they're pretty serious, a lot of them. And I want to do preventative work as well with these students. Like, I want to go do elder checks. I want to do follow-ups. I want to do, if there's suicidal ideation, we go there and we follow up with them daily and have a service like that where we're doing preventative care, not just showing up when it's too late, because that's what we do now. We can't help it. We only have one or two people. Yeah. But I'd really like to have a system in place too, for preventative measures, yeah, and different things. Yeah.
I think what's important about that too is training students, especially high school age or just around high school age, in their own community. It actually also builds that possibility of what work looks like in their mm-hmm. own community as well. Yeah. So are you seeing that? Like, that students are seeing maybe that possibility? Or
I think so. And I think what I want it to develop is a sense of pride and purpose in a lot of the students in the community. So I want the students to be from the community, in the community, working for the community. That's the goal. And to have them have a sense of pride about it and stuff, and to be, when they go to significant calls, to be recognized, like in the feast hall or something like that, to have that aspect be a part of it as well. Because it happens lots when you go on rough calls, and I've been to many, and I'm recognized in the feast hall and thanked and given a gift or something. And that would be really significant, I think, for these guys, for the students. So there's a big cultural aspect that would play into it as well. And just having a sense of pride and purpose in your community would be really good, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Is there anything else I didn't ask that you want to include in this?
Three of my students were also my kindergarten students that I taught this year that are now licensed. They were my kindergarten students.
Oh my God.
And two of them are my God kids / kindergarten students. Yeah. Yeah. That's just cool. It was just like full circle.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really good. I'm glad you added that.
I'm getting old. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. No problem.
Looking ahead at the community of Whitsett's emergency preparedness involves more than paramedics. So I sat down with Chris Turner at the CSEK station last week to discuss what other emergency systems are needed and how Indigenous communities are facing the challenge of providing these services with smaller community numbers in rural areas. The Whitsett First Nation relies on a small but dedicated volunteer fire department to handle emergencies in the community. With just 10 to 12 firefighters serving a population of about 700, the department responds to a range of calls, but most are medical emergencies as well as wildfire and structural fire calls, though those are less frequent. Matt Anderson and Chris Turner are working to update these programs in Whitsett, where ambulance response times can be long and volunteer resources are limited. Recruitment remains a challenge, as small population size make it harder to fill volunteer roles for fire and emergency management services.
Hi, my name is Chris Turner. I'm the emergency program coordinator for the Whitsett First Nation. I got into the field of emergency management through my firefighting experience through Smithers Fire Rescue. Through the last 7 years of building that capacity and experience, I started working for First Nations Emergency Services Society, helping First Nations communities with fire prevention and public education and training of fire departments if they did that. Whitsett Emergency Management started July of last year after the wildfire season of the John Brown Creek wildfire. They saw the importance of having somebody in a role like emergency management out there. So I started building this department last year in July, which subsequently led to the Quarry Creek wildfire last year, which we were a little more prepared for with having somebody in the role.
And have you collected volunteers or other staff, or is it just you for now?
We did have a Fire Smart coordinator that was in place prior to me getting there. They vacated the role, so we're going to be looking to fill that one as a paid employee again. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's building capacity within the nation itself mm-hmm. through volunteers and through the band administration.
Yeah. Something that I saw was that part of the value or the vision is to protect the community while also honoring tradition. Can you tell me what's the Venn diagram? What does that look like for emergency management?
Yeah, I mean, it's pulling on the historical and cultural knowledge from throughout the decades and hundreds of years from elders and other people within the community that have that firsthand experience with previous emergencies or fires mm-hmm. within the community, and just integrating that into the programming we're trying to build with emergency management.
I did speak to Matt Anderson, and we were talking a little bit about the future of what emergency management looks like in Whitsett. So are you able to tell me what that looks like coming down the line from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the emergency management department's super fresh. We've made pretty good progress in the last year with working on redoing the emergency management plan and building capacity, getting the fire department up and active again, mm-hmm. and building these interagency relationships between emergency management, climate readiness, Indigenous Services Canada, other organizations like Smithers Fire Rescue. So it's pretty much building off of that into the future with expanding those relationships and developing a regional approach to emergency management so we can mitigate future fires and emergencies together as a region.
So for listeners who maybe aren't from here, Whitsett is equidistant between Hazelton and Smithers. So emergency responses would typically have to come from one of those communities. What part of this is being taught by yourself or Matt Anderson to build the next generation of youth in Whitsett now to prepare them for when more infrastructure and more, like you said, more agencies, there's more people in place? Are you managing that part now where you're working with youth and getting people to volunteer and be part of building something from the ground up in Whitsett?
Yeah, so Matt Anderson, he's doing some great things through the iCount school there with the EMR, Emergency mm-hmm. Medical Responder Program. So getting some youth and, like you said, the next generation interested in the medical response side of things. Yeah. And when it comes to my side, I'm assisting him with that, but also with the fire department trying to inspire the next generation to come and fill those boots mm-hmm. to come and mitigate some of the future emergencies as well. So yeah. Ultimately, they're our next line of defense into the future. So we really want to try and get them hooked and interested in this.
Yeah, having programs that kind of immediately are like, it's career path, but it's also, these are exhilarating jobs too that people are thinking about. And being in the medical field, I think a lot of people might not know that's their future too. Are you seeing that trend yet, or is it just too early to tell?
Yeah, people aren't super exposed to it, or the youth exposed to it. Like when I was growing up, my dad was on the volunteer fire department in Gittinmax, and I was exposed to that, but you don't know it as I didn't see it as like a potential career back then.
Yeah.
The nearest career fire departments would be Terrace and Prince George. So the youth aren't super exposed to that stuff. So it's trying to build some programming and build some capacity for that to be a potential career for them one day, whether it's through Matt's medical program and trying to get some paid medical responders one day, or through the fire department, or even through my role as emergency program coordinator, getting some youth involved in this kind of thing. We did just get a junior fire smart coordinator who's working right now, yeah. and that's one of the starting points for these youth that we're trying to do.
Did your emergency management department, did you apply for grants, receive grants through this? And if so, can you speak to what they went to as well?
Yeah, for sure. Any of those grants, you got to get creative with some of the funding opportunities out there for emergency management on reserve. So the CEPF funds through UBCM are a perfect example of how to access some kind of quick and reliable funds there. So we were successful with getting the fire department equipment and training grant, which we used to buy some pretty necessary equipment for the fire department there.
Such as?
Hoses, nozzles, hand tools, that kind of thing. Just the basics they need to safely and effectively do what they do out there. Mm-hmm. And then we were also successful with doing the Emergency Operations Center stream of funding through them. So we built some capacity within the BAN administration and built an Emergency Operations Center team and got a third party to come and train us. And then some additional equipment that's needed for an emergency operations center.
What are some of the unique challenges of planning for emergency preparedness? What's unique about doing it on reserve versus in a community such as Smithers or Houston or Hazelton?
So my specific role and the BAN administration were confined to the IR, the Indian Reserve boundaries of where we can operate. Like we can go a little bit outside of that to assist with some emergencies outside of that, but ultimately the funding and everything is confined to there for what I do.
Okay.
So a little bit different than Smithers or another municipality there.
Yeah.
And then just accessing funds. There's not a tax base to pull funding from for, say, like the fire department and whatnot. So you're finding other avenues to get that funding and reallocate funds to get that. Currently working on a few project proposals to get funding through Indigenous Services Canada to fund some of the things that I want to do with the emergency management department out there.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of... Most reserves in BC, northern BC, are fairly small too. So when you're relying on volunteers to fill boots at the fire department or fill these roles within emergency management, like the emergency ESS program?
Yeah.
We're looking for volunteers for that. But when your population is small, you don't have a ton of volunteers. So it's hard to get people.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you to WITSET Emergency Program Coordinator Chris Turner and paramedic and educator Matt Anderson for speaking with me about WITSET's emergency response plans for the future. And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.